Sure, let me do that here. Is that any better? Can you hear it any clearer? Okay, we're at the top of the hour now, so I'm going to have to get us started. Alan, I'm going to need you to refresh your slides so that we can record. Okay, I think we're ready to go. Welcome, everyone, to the end of our 2008 Legal Issues webinar series. Our session today is going to be on the topic of direct threat and safety in the workplace. Our speakers are Barry Taylor and Alan Goldstein from Equip for Equality, the protection and advocacy agency in the state of Illinois. Barry and Alan have been our speakers throughout this series this past year, and we thank them for their time and effort in this program, and we hope that everyone enjoys the session today. I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to them and let them take it at this time. So go ahead, Alan and Barry.
Thanks, Robin. And if anybody has any difficulty hearing me, feel free to type that in, and I'll watch for those cues as we're going along. So as Robin mentioned, today's topic is direct threat and safety in the workplace. And Al and I are going to divide up the presentation. We're first going to start with an overview of what direct threat topics are, and here you'll see them on your screen. I'll talk first about the foundations of direct threat, a case that was decided before the ADA was passed called R-Line. Then I'll talk a little bit about the ADA and the regulations, what they say about direct threat. We'll talk a little bit about the scope of direct threat, who it affects, and what context it affects. And then at that point, I'll turn it over to Alan to delve into some of the cases and issues that are relevant to direct threat, including individualized assessment of the person's ability to do the job, medical judgment issues. And then after he's done with those two issues, we'll take a break, see if there's any questions, and then I'll resume with the last two topics, which are when can a reasonable accommodations reduce or eliminate a direct threat, what the case law has said on that, and also talk about a couple additional issues in direct threat case law that have been emerging. And then we'll open it up for further questions at that point. So as I mentioned, the foundation of the ADA's direct threat really is based on a Supreme Court case that was decided before the ADA was even passed. It was a case that was brought under the Rehabilitation Act that was passed in the 1970s, and I'm sure as most of you know, that law was passed. That law was passed to protect people against discrimination in entities that receive federal funding. And so this was brought on behalf of a school teacher who worked for a school that received federal funding, and that's why it was applicable under Section 504 of the Rehab Act. And as many of you know, the definition of disability is identical between the ADA and the Rehab Act, and so a lot of the case law that's developed under the Rehab Act has been very instructional for courts in deciding the ADA. So this was a case that was brought by a teacher, as I said before, and she had tuberculosis. And interestingly, she had had originally tuberculosis back in 1957. That's when it first showed up for her. But then it went into remission for about 20 years. And so it then became more active in the late 70s, and that's when the school became concerned about possible danger in the workplace. And interestingly, the first issue was not really about direct threat, but whether or not tuberculosis was even a disability. And at that point, there really hadn't been any case law about contagious diseases and whether those were really what they wanted to cover within disability for the Rehab Act. And the court confirmed that, yes, contagious diseases are disabilities, and this sounds like something that, you know, should have been a real easy thing to solve, but it was groundbreaking in that this had never really been decided by a major court before. So that was important. The argument the other side had was they were saying it really what the ADA or the Rehab Act was intended to do was to protect discrimination based on the effects on themselves, not on the effects their disability may have on others, and the court rejected that. The other thing that was interesting in this case is that not only did she plead that she had an actual disability, but she also pleaded that because she had this history of disability, she was protected under the Rehab Act as discrimination based on her record of disability. And this is really the major Supreme Court case on record of disability. So when those issues come up, it's instructed to look at this case. And for those of you who are interested in the actual citation of the case, that's not listed on this slide, but it's at 480 U.S. 273, 1987. So it was, this case was decided 3 years before the ADA was passed. And ultimately the Supreme I had the lock key on, but it wasn't working, so I'll just hold the control key. I'm not sure what the problem was, but I'll just continue to hold the key, Robin. Thanks for letting me know you lost me. And I'm not sure exactly when I went out, but I was getting to the point where we were describing the case. And the case was about the woman, who, whether or not she was a threat in the workplace or not. And the Supreme Court ultimately found that that the lower court did not do a proper analysis on direct threat. They said, really, you should not be making decisions based on diagnosis alone. You have to do an individualized assessment. And as you see on the slide there, they said, you know, the fact that some people who have a contagious disease can pose health risks doesn't mean that you should assume that everybody does. And that's why you have to do this individualized assessment and how that particular person's disease or disability impacts them, and the fact that they have a particular diagnosis isn't enough information. And they talked about really what discrimination law is about is protecting the rights of the person to be free from discrimination and balancing that with avoiding exposing anybody to significant health and safety risks. The other thing that they said in this decision that was really important, and you'll see over and over in the ADA direct threat cases, is that you have to rely upon reasonable medical judgment of public health officials. They also said that you have to, even if somebody looks like they may pose a direct threat, before you make any adverse decision, you have to explore whether any reasonable accommodations are available. Before you make that adverse decision, any reasonable accommodation that may reduce the threat that exists. And that's really key, and the Supreme Court decision really laid the groundwork for the ADA's provisions on that. And the other thing that they did that was significant, and you're going to see this over and over in the cases that we talk about, is they identified four important factors that courts need to look at when reviewing direct threat. The first one is the nature of the risk. And by nature of the risk, they mean how the disease was transmitted or would be transmitted. Then you look at the duration of the risk. And by that, they just mean how long the person has been infectious and how long they will continue to be infectious. The severity of the risk is the next factor. And that really is when you're looking at the potential harm to other people. And then the last one would be the probability of the risk and the likelihood of the harm. So even if it's a severe risk, if it's very unlikely to happen, that would undercut the ability to find it to being a direct threat. In this particular case, the court wasn't able to determine whether this person met these four factors or not because there wasn't enough facts determined at the trial court. So they sent the case back. But what they did in doing so before they sent it back is they really just developed the framework that all ADA direct threat cases are now founded upon. And really this analysis in this case has been incorporated not only into the ADA and the regulations, but all subsequent court decisions. Moving on to the next slide. Thanks, Alan. So you'll see here we have the definition of direct threat in the ADA and the definition of the direct threat under the EEOC's regulations. And it's interesting that they're not identical. And that's caused some confusion. And the courts have cleared up that confusion a little bit. We'll talk about it in a second. But I wanted to go over this real quickly with people because there are some differences. You'll see the definition of direct threat. It says a significant risk to the safety, health or safety of others that cannot be eliminated by reasonable accommodation. But then you look at the EEOC's definition and they add some additional words. So instead of just saying a significant risk, they say a significant risk of substantial harm. So what that means is you don't have to, you not only have to show there's a risk, but a very high likelihood I mean, not only that there's a likelihood of a problem, but that the problem that you're talking about is a substantial problem. So even if there's a high risk that something would happen, if it's not that big a deal, if it's not going to cause that much harm, it wouldn't be a direct threat. So that really narrows the definition of what's considered a direct threat. Then they say to the health or safety of the individual or others. And that actually expands the definition of direct threat beyond threat to other people, but to threat to the person themselves, that their disability somehow is threatening themselves in the workplace. And then they say that cannot be eliminated or reduced by reasonable accommodation. So the text of the ADA seemed to eliminate the complete direct threat, but the EEOC tempers that a little bit and says not only you don't necessarily have to eliminate it, but you at least have to reduce it to a level where it's not a significant risk of substantial harm. So when these two things came out, there was a lot of confusion, I think, both for employers as well as people with disabilities, that really which definition of disability of direct threat was were the courts going to follow, and we'll see what the courts have done with that as we move forward. And you'll also see that in the ADA regulations, they adopted the four R-line factors we talked about, and Alan's going to talk about these more, so I'm not going to go through those, but those are basically the same factors we talked about before. And they also adopted some of the other reasoning in R-line about looking at using reasonable medical judgment in direct threat cases, as well as relying on current medical knowledge and objective evidence. Next slide. They also gave some guidance to employers, which I think is something that might be helpful as you're moving forward with some of these issues in your own workplace. They talk about how it's important to identify the specific risk that's involved, not just make some generalizations about what possible risks there are, but really identify the specific risk. And then for people with mental illness, they talk about identifying the specific behavior that's involved, or people with disabilities that are physical in nature, identifying the aspect of that disability that would pose a direct threat. And I think it just continues to reaffirm that you need to be very specific in these kinds of cases when making any decisions based on direct threat. Next slide. They also give a little bit of other information about what employers should do. Again, not only based on individual factual data, but also they put specifically here not to base it on fears, generalizations, or stereotypes, and also to consider the reasonable accommodations that we talked about that was discussed in our line. And then they also gave employers some ideas about how they can figure out what's the relevant evidence. And these aren't things that employers have to do, but it's things that the EEOC recommends that you do, like getting input from the person with a disability about, you know, what's going on for them with their disability, learning about the disability, learning about what possible accommodations might be helpful for their particular disability. Looking at the person's experience in previous jobs or previous similar positions. And then also looking to medical professionals who understand the disability, and also people who have direct knowledge of the specific person and their disability. And all that evidence can be helpful in the employer making a very objective and reasoned decision rather than sort of a knee-jerk decision. One other thing I just wanted to mention is that if you look at all the ADA cases that are out there involving direct threat, it's interesting that four disabilities seem to come up over and over again. And those four disabilities are HIV, epilepsy, mental illness, and diabetes. And I don't think it's coincidence that those are the ones that are coming up. I mean, in my view, one of the reasons those four continue to come up is that those four tend to have a lot of stigma attached to them. There often is fear with respect to those particular disabilities and ignorance about those disabilities. So especially in the early years of HIV, there was a lot of fear about how HIV is transmitted and a lot of ignorance about that. And certainly there continues to be a lot of stigma for people with HIV. Also, I think a lot of fear and stigma regarding people with mental illness, epilepsy, and even diabetes sometimes. And that's why we continue to see these coming up. And really, that's why the ADA was passed, was to get past some of those fear and broad generalizations and stereotypes about particular disabilities, and why it's so important to have individualized assessment and to rely upon objective evidence. What's been troubling, at least from my perspective, is that even though the ADA sets up a clear standard that you have to show a significant risk of substantial harm in these kinds of cases, in many cases, the courts don't necessarily follow that standard. In my previous position, I did a lot of representation of people with HIV, and whenever we did any cases involving a person with HIV in the medical field, these cases were very hard to win. We had a case that's referenced here, the estate of Morrow versus Borges, and it was a gentleman who worked at a hospital, and his job was, he was a medical assistant in the operating room, and his job was to hand over the different instruments to the doctors. And they found out that he had HIV, and they were concerned that somehow he might get pricked by one of the instruments, and somehow his blood would get into the patient and infect patients. And even though there were certainly precautions about what to do if you happen to get, you know, pricked by an instrument, and there was a lot of evidence that once HIV is exposed to the air that it dies quickly, these were cases, and in this particular case, the court felt that the substantial harm of transmitting HIV, especially then before a lot of the drugs had come out, overwhelmed and really sort of subsumed the significant risk. So even though the risk was very low in these cases, the harm was viewed to be so big that that was enough for a direct threat, which, again, is contrary to how the EEOC has laid out the standard. The next thing we want to talk about is the scope of direct threat. And really what we're looking at here is who is encompassed within direct threat and where is it involved. So when we talk about who, the question is, does direct threat include threat to others as is laid out in the statute, or does it also include threat to self, any fact that your disability would have an adverse impact on yourself in the workplace? And then when we're talking about where, we're talking about, does the direct threat have to occur only in the workplace, or can off-duty conduct also be considered when you're evaluating direct threat? So moving to the who piece of it all, as I mentioned before, there's a conflict between the way the direct threat is defined in the text of the ADA, that it's limited to threat to other people in the workplace, and the EEOC regulations, which broaden direct threat to include threat to self as well as to others. And for years, we had contrary court decisions going back and forth. And then in 2002, go to the next slide, we had the Supreme Court resolve this issue. And this was a case, Chevron versus Achazabal. And you see the citation there for this particular case. And this was a gentleman who had hepatitis C, and he worked in an area that had exposure to chemicals. And there was concern by the employer that him being exposed to these chemicals would be adverse to his own health. So this was not a situation where they were concerned about him transmitting hepatitis C to others. It was about his hepatitis C being compromising his health when he was exposed to these chemicals. And the employer had a doctor who said that it was a threat, and the employee put forth evidence of his doctor saying it was not a threat. And he was ultimately fired, and he sued under the ADA. And the employer said he is a threat to himself, and relying upon the EEOC regulations, said that should be enough. And the Supreme Court agreed with the employer, and they said an employer may refuse to hire an applicant if performing the job would endanger their own health. And so while people may agree or disagree, that's what the Supreme Court said, and unless they overturn themselves later, which I think is highly unlikely, this expands direct threat defense for employers to not only cover threat to other people, but threats to themselves. And this was a concern of the disability community, not just this specific case, but you know, one of the concerns about in disability advocacy is this whole view of paternalism and the people making decisions for people with disabilities and making decisions about what decisions they make about their own disability and what decisions they make about risk to their own health. And a lot of people were concerned that by expanding this definition, it really was going to undercut the ability for people with disabilities to make decisions about themselves in the workplace, and that employers shouldn't have the ability to make that judgment for them. But again, because the Supreme Court has made that decision, we really don't have, I mean, that's that's the law of the land, and that's where we are now. Moving on to the next topic, which is where. There's been a question, too, does direct threat apply to actions that are outside of the employment setting? Do you, as an employer, have to only rely upon any kind of activity or problems that have happened in the employment setting, or can you look outside to other situations that have happened and use those in making your direct threat determination? And courts, this has not come up a lot, but in those cases where it has come up, courts have found that if an employee has engaged in conduct that rises to the level of direct threat outside of the context of the employment situation, they can rely upon that in deeming somebody a direct threat. And interestingly, the cases that are out there are very similar in facts in that they usually involve people who have a disability of alcoholism. And while they're not having problems on the job related to their alcoholism, they're having difficulties outside and getting involved in, you know, barroom brawls or some sort of other types of scuffles with people related to their alcohol. And in most of these cases, they're involving people who have public service type of jobs, like a policeman or a fireman, that sort of thing. And courts have said you can look at that off-duty conduct to make a decision about direct threat. So that gets us to our next topic, which is assessing the potential for harm. And I'm going to turn it over to Alan to talk about those issues.
Okay, thank you, Barry and Robin. I'm going to be trying with the lock talk key, so if I fade out, someone could let me know, that'd be great, but otherwise I have to be clicking and turning pages. And we see there a picture of something that probably would constitute a significant risk of substantial harm, and I think the harm would be deemed imminent and severe. Going to the next slide, again, we have the four factors laid out in our line that Barry talked about: the duration of the risk, the nature and severity of the harm, the likelihood the harm will occur, and the imminence of the harm. And again, all direct threat decisions must be based on an individualized assessment and on a reasonable medical judgment that relies on the most current medical knowledge or the best available objective evidence. And I think some of the key words in here, obviously the best available objective evidence comes up, I think, in the case, maybe not explicitly, but you can see in the court ruling where the evidence seems stronger on one side, the court usually goes to that side. And again, reasonable accommodations must always be examined to see if the direct threat can be reduced or eliminated before any adverse employment action is taken by the employer. First case we're going to talk about does a nice job going through the four factors we just discussed, Branham versus Snow. And this was someone who wanted to be an IRS criminal investigator, and we have their Treasury Secretary, or former Treasury Secretary, John Snow. And this employee had depression, and I don't know, it says frequently missed work there, but I think the real issue was that he was now applying for a new position within the IRS to be a criminal investigator. And I just want to talk a little bit from the case. I think I loaded up the wrong slide. It says depression, and that's actually a mistake. It should be diabetes. So I apologize for that error. But it should be diabetes, and I want to read a little bit. The court talks about his diabetes. He has type 1 insulin-dependent diabetes, which is a non-curable metabolic condition characterized by elevated blood sugar or hypoglycemia. People with this condition use insulin to lower their blood sugar levels, although excessive use of insulin can cause problems as well. And a person with mild to moderate hypoglycemia, but this person has type 1 diabetes, which means he's insulin dependent, and a person with mild to moderate hypoglycemia may experience symptoms including tremors, sweating, and irritability. And Mr. Branham did in fact have that from time to time, but he did not have any major hypoglycemic episodes. And a severe hypoglycemic episode may lead to unconsciousness and convulsions and may be life-threatening. The plaintiff in this case, Mr. Branham, did use insulin, and he always keeps with him additional insulin. He monitors his blood sugar 4 to 5 times a day. and is able to correct any deviations in his blood sugar that needs correcting. And he was, in fact, a 12-year employee with the IRS at the time that he applied for the criminal investigator position. Hi, can people hear me now? That's not coming up over here. Okay, what about now? Are people hearing me? Okay, sorry about that. I switched from the lock talk key to holding down the control key, and I guess there were still problems. So I'm going to keep my finger down, and please let me know. So going back to Mr. Branham, I'm not sure what was cut out, but he had worked for 12 years at the IRS. He did not have any major hypoglycemic episodes. He had some mild to moderate episodes, which included sweating and tremors, but he was able to take insulin when needed or have a snack and adjust his blood sugar. And so he pretty much had it under control. And in this case, the court looked at the four factors identified in our line and in the EEOC regulations. And first, they looked at the duration of the risk. And the IRS maintained that he had experienced significant long and short-term changes in his blood glucose levels that could affect his performance. And the plaintiff and his doctor said, well, yes, diabetes cannot be cured, but Mr. Branham is able to effectively control his condition so that there is no real duration of risk. And the facts borne out the fact that he was able to control his condition. So the court said, regarding the duration of the risk, it is not significant. The next factor the court looked at is the nature and severity of the risk. And the IRS maintained that drastic changes in his blood sugar could significantly degrade his abilities to function as a special agent, potentially endangering him, Mr. Branham, his colleagues, and the public. And Mr. Branham conceded that the risk of severe hypoglycemia can include incapacitation, confusion, coma, and death, but he has never lost consciousness and never experienced any physical or mental incapacitation as a result of his mild hypoglycemia. And those other extreme reactions are for a more severe form of hypoglycemia. And the court concluded, based on this conflicting evidence, that a reasonable trier of fact could conclude that any hypoglycemia experienced by Mr. Branham will not impair him in the performance of his duties. And again, I think what was very important to the court is just the facts of Mr. Branham's diabetes. He did have it under control. He did not have any of these severe episodes, either at work or not at work. And I think that helped establish that he was not a severe risk in terms of this condition as well. Next, the court looked at the likelihood of potential harm. And the IRS endocrinologist theorized that the employee's program of intensive treatment was associated with an increased risk of severe hypoglycemia. And that some of the job responsibilities may increase Mr. Branham's risk of experiencing severe hypoglycemia. The employee's doctor gave a statistic, which I assume was supported, that the risk of Mr. Branham suffering a severe hypoglycemic reaction was only 0.2% per year, or 0.0002, a very small likelihood. And while there was theoretically maybe some issues, as the IRS pointed out, for Mr. Branham, the risk seemed much smaller. And as the IRS did not have any evidence to counter the statistical evidence presented by the employee, the court concluded that a reasonable jury could find that the likelihood of harm was quite low. And the court keeps talking about a reasonable jury, just so everyone knows. A lot of these cases are decided on summary judgment, which in the anatomy of a lawsuit is after the sides have exchanged a lot of information known as discovery. And then there's a motion, and essentially side moving for summary judgment, usually the employer is claiming there's no dispute of facts. A reasonable jury would find every fact in our favor, even giving the benefit of the doubt to the employee on any factual disputes. And the court here did not find for summary judgment, finding that in every factual situation, a reasonable jury could find in favor of the employee and possibly the employer, but the court doesn't supersede a jury. A court just sees if a reasonable fact finder or a reasonable jury could find for the party who is actually resisting the summary judgment motion. So I hope that procedural technical aspect is somewhat clear. But when you hear the courts talking about a reasonable jury, they're looking to see if a reasonable jury can interpret the facts using all reasonable inferences to decide for the employee. And if the facts do support such a conclusion, then the court will deny summary judgment, and then the jury gets to decide. Looking at the fourth factor in this case is the imminence of potential harm. Mr. Branham mentioned he has never suffered any period of incapacitation or other hypoglycemic episode at work or elsewhere, and there is no medical evidence that he will do so in the future. Remember, it needs to be the best available objective evidence. And the IRS says that's not logical. And the court said a reasonable trier of fact can conclude that Mr. Branham can prevent severe hypoglycemia, and in fact I think has been preventing it, and eliminate any imminence with respect to the risk of harm. So the court said that there is a genuine issue of material fact as to whether Mr. Branham can perform the essential functions of his position without being a direct threat to health or safety, and since there was an issue as to material fact, the employer, the IRS, loses on summary judgment, and the case can proceed to a jury. Sorry, this next case is Darnell versus Thermofiber, which was also from the Seventh Circuit and involved another individual with type 1 diabetes, but in this time we had a very different result. Mr. Darnell's diabetes was not under control, and a pre-employment physical, which was given to all incoming employees as required, found that his diabetes was not in control. In this case, the employee's doctor even admitted that the diabetes was not under control. And the employee argued, well, the employer only did one blood sugar glucose analysis. They didn't really do the best available objective testing necessary to come to that conclusion. But the court disagreed, and I think especially as the employee's own doctor found that his diabetes was uncontrolled. The court held that where a person's diabetes is uncontrolled, in this situation he could pose a direct threat, and they talked a lot about Thermofiber's work environment. It could get up to 110 degrees in the workplace, and so it was a very challenging work environment. And they held for Mr. Darnell, because his diabetes was not under control, that he could pose a direct threat, especially with the dangerous machinery around and everything. And I think in this case, there wasn't as much as a factual dispute. And employers sometimes ask me, can we monitor employees? Can we make sure they take medication and do what they need to help treat their condition? And generally, employers should not be in the business of monitoring an employee's treatment, but if an employee does not follow a treatment regimen and their condition becomes to such a point where they do pose a direct threat, then they're no longer qualified, or they pose a direct threat and adverse employment actions can be taken on the basis that they're not qualified, not a case of their treatment regimen, condition as it exists now. And there's another case, I have a but C down there for Rodriguez versus ConAgra, and this was Rodriguez briefly was an individual with type 2 diabetes, which is generally not quite as serious, but there the employer just knew of the diagnosis and said, oh, we think that's dangerous, we think it's not controlled, which wasn't entirely accurate, therefore we won't hire Mr. Rodriguez. And the court again pointed out that the employer must conduct an independent individualized assessment and not base decisions on generalizations and false beliefs. And I think even though those three cases all involved diabetes and went in different directions, I think you can see that it really depends on what is the condition of the individual involved. How does it affect them? What are their particular job duties? What is their state of their condition? Can they control their condition or not? Is it unsafe or is it not? What's the evidence in terms of how they have been working with the condition? If there's years of evidence that they're able to work safely, I often find that to be somewhat persuasive. The next case we're going to talk about is Hatzikos versus Acme American Refrigeration. This was an employee with depression who frequently missed work. And the manager asked, and there was a little dispute how the disclosure came about, but it sounds like at one point the manager says, well, do you have some type of mental illness? Are you depressed? And the employee admitted that they did have depression, and immediately the manager put the person on leave pending a medical review to see if they were safe to work in the workplace. The doctor conducting the review indicated the employee was stable and was not dangerous, but the employer said, well, we want more than that. We actually want a guarantee, and the word guarantee is actually in the decision, that you can assure us that the employer, that there's absolutely no threat. We want that kind of guarantee. And of course, the doctor could not do that. I think one thing that we need to keep in mind is, you know, this maybe sounds wrong, but we're all human beings, and there's no guarantee that any condition is going to stay as it is or change. Someone can be healthy one minute and suffer a heart attack or have a stroke, and things, even healthy individuals can undergo situations that, you know, may be dangerous for them or others, but that's just the nature of health and the nature of life. And to expect guarantees that, no, I can guarantee this person won't have a seizure, won't have a stroke, that's just something that's not possible. So the doctor said, I think he's stable, I think he can work safely, but I cannot guarantee that there's absolutely no threat. And because of that, the employer did not put him back to work. At that point, he was left on medical leave for a long time, I believe 18 months, and then the manager discharged the employee for poor attendance and also for posing a safety risk. Although there were really no safety-related complaints from any coworkers. And the court found in this case that the defendants did not present any evidence that there was a significant risk of substantial harm. The defendants did not identify the nature of the risk posed by the plaintiff's psychological condition, much less the likelihood or the imminence of any potential harm. The court reemphasized, as we all know, that the ADA requires analysis on a case-by-case, individualized basis, and that the probability, and the court also emphasized, the probability of significant harm must be substantial, more than just a remote or a slightly increased risk. And the picture we have is Acme makes refrigerators, but I think they also make rockets, as we can see in the little cartoon. So those were the cases going through the individualized assessment and the four factors outlined in our line and the ADA regulations. A question that comes up a lot is, when can an employer seek medical information and how can an employer use medical information? And we're going to talk a little bit about that now. As I mentioned before, the nature of medical evidence is important, and employers are generally on strong ground if there's medical substantiation for their conclusion that the employee poses a direct threat to health and safety. However, when employers rely on the opinion of company doctors, or even worse, on stereotypes, and just ignore contrary medical opinions, or in some cases we'll see, get the company doctor to try to persuade the other medical providers to change their opinions, courts are less likely to find to an employer. And courts are generally more willing to defer to a treating physician because they know that employee's condition better than most other doctors. And because of the individualized assessment, the opinion of a treating physician is very important in these cases. First case we're going to look at is Ward versus Merck, which involved a pharmaceutical employee with mental illness, including anxiety and panic disorders. And this person was stressed and beginning to experience some problems at work. He requested and received a reduced work schedule, but the problems persisted. And according to the record, the employee began to engage in strange behavior, including an episode in the Merck's cafeteria, which was deemed as resulting from a brief psychotic disorder. It's actually funny, in the appellate court opinion, the court just went out of their way not to mention what happened in the cafeteria, which of course made me a little curious as to what happened in the cafeteria. So I went back to the district court opinion just to see if they had more specific facts. And the most we can get is, according to the police report, the employee backed himself up against the food tables and was screaming at people, telling them not to eat any of their vegetables. Maybe kind of the opposite of what we were told by our parents years ago, that we should eat our vegetables. Merck security called the police, and when they arrived, the officers noted that the plaintiff seemed dazed, couldn't tell them his last name, and incoherent. The individual was taken to the hospital, evaluated. At that time, they also diagnosed schizophrenia, and he was released. And their other co-workers claims that the employee walked around like a zombie, their word, not mine, and also had a temper tantrum, and I think more than one. Based on the employee's conduct, and I think it's important to emphasize, I think Merck's decision was based on conduct, not just the diagnosis. The employer requested a fitness for work evaluation with a company physician. The employee refused, saying, "You have no right to send me for the examination," was suspended without pay, sent a letter saying, "You have 48 hours to show for the examination." The employee did not, and was terminated, and then filed suit. Now, the law that applies regarding medical examinations says that employers cannot require medical examinations or make medical inquiries of an employee unless the examination or inquiry is job-related and consistent with business necessity. And sometimes you'll hear talk of the business necessity defense, and that's what this kind of falls under. And in general, direct threat is seen as something as an affirmative defense that employers have to prove. Employees do not have to prove an absence of direct threat. Rather, employers have to prove the existence of a direct threat, although there is a split of the circuits, and we're going to talk a little bit about that later. In this case, the court said that Merck had the burden of showing a direct threat, but the court also said that the possible threats to employee safety, again, based on the employee's conduct, not on the employee's diagnosis alone, that these threats were sufficient to meet the business necessity element and to allow Merck to require a fitness for work evaluation. Going on to the next case, it's Taylor versus USF. This involved a forklift driver who experienced two seizures, and I believe that two unexplained seizures is one of the diagnostic criteria for epilepsy, which I believe actually the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court was diagnosed with, because he had two unexplained seizures, even though they were many, many years apart. For Mr. Taylor, a neurologist determined that his condition was consistent with seizure disorder, and Mr. Taylor told his employer that he had what he called infantile epilepsy. As a result, the employee was put on leave and not allowed to drive a forklift, or not allowed to work, for 18 months. During this period, while he was off work, the employee was examined by two other physicians, both of which cleared him to return to work, but after talking to the company doctor, these other physicians changed their position. I think the company doctor talked some about the job duties, because I think when doctors give medical opinions, it's very important that they have a good understanding of the essential job functions and what the employee is going to be doing on the job. And the company doctors kind of persuaded the physicians to change their opinion, although I believe there were also other physicians who were not persuaded by the company doctor. There was a lot of cross-medical evidence in this case. The court ruled that the employer's refusal to let the employee return to work was based only on the assessment of the company doctors who were reporting to and retained by the employer, and that the employer also used the company doctor to get the other doctors to change their medical opinions. Thus, the court found that the employer based their decision not really on the best available objective medical evidence. It was clearly very subjective medical evidence. And the court found that the employer actually regarded the employee as being disabled, and held that it violated the ADA. And again, under the analysis part, I think one of the caveats are if the company doctor disagrees strongly with the treating physician, employers are maybe on shaky ground is the right word, or it's a lot harder to justify a direct threat defense when there is contrary medical opinion showing that there is no direct threat. So I think it's very important to consider all medical opinions. Again, reasonable medical judgment, best available objective medical evidence. And the last case I'm going to talk about is the Justice versus Crown, Cork, and Seal, which involved an electrician who had a stroke resulting in vertigo. He appeared unsteady to others, but generally had no difficulty walking or standing. Some of his essential job functions included climbing ladders, walking on catwalks, using power presses and cutters. The medical report said that he should not work at unprotected heights, and the employer actually eliminated that job requirement, and the employee was able to work as an electrician with no problem for 2 years or so before a new supervisor came on board and had concerns. And just an aside, what we see as an advocacy agency, we see a lot of the cases that come through our door involve new supervisors. And generally it's the kind of situation where the new supervisor doesn't want to continue the accommodation put in place by the old supervisor. And I think that's a tough position for a company to uphold unless there's some intervening conduct or changes which justify terminating the reasonable accommodation. And I think employers can prevent a lot of these problems through ADA training, periodic training for all staff, but also providing training for new supervisors. Often the new supervisors come in with very little ADA knowledge, and that often is what leads them to remove or eliminate a reasonable accommodation that was in place. The employer, based on this new supervisor, requested several medical evaluations, and most of these cleared the employee to return to work. A physical therapist retained by the company initially cleared the employee to return to work with safety equipment, but then the supervisor took the physical therapist to the job site and convinced the physical therapist to change their opinion, and the therapist did an about-face and said, no, the employee should find a new, safer job. The final evaluation from Crown's medical director restricted the employee, Mr. Justice, from jobs that required him to maintain balance, work at heights, or work near moving equipment. And Mr. Justice was reassigned to a janitorial position, which was kind of interesting because even in the janitorial position, he had to work around moving equipment, and the employer didn't seem to be concerned with him moving or working around moving equipment in a janitorial position, although they did seem to have concerns about him working around moving equipment as an electrician. The employee filed at the EEOC, and the court, one, looking at the disability issue, found that he was regarded as being disabled because Crown believed that Mr. Justice's balance problems significantly restricted his ability to work at a broad range of jobs. And then was he qualified to work as an electrician or work safely? The court looked at the fact that he was able to work safely with the unprotected height restriction for several years, leading to the inference that he was able to continue to do the electrician job despite this restriction. The court concluded that there is evidence that these hazards were imagined or exaggerated, and that Crown's purported reliance on Justice's medical restrictions was a pretext, masking Crown's irrational fears about Justice's condition. And again, when the employer's doctor is persuading other doctors, or sometimes very contrary to other doctors, and there's evidence on the ground what the employee did for 2 years prior to his being put on leave, I think the evidence of what the employee did up to the point where the employer refuses to let him work anymore is very strong. And in most cases where the employee is able to work safely up until the day the employer tells them they have to stop working, the employee, I think, in those cases has strong evidence that they're able to do the job safely. And I think at this point we're going to pause for questions, so I'm going to remove my tired finger from the control key and open it up for questions.
If individuals are interested in asking questions, you can do that by either typing it in or pressing the control key and speaking into your microphone. Alan, it seems you've overwhelmed them with information here, so maybe you want to go ahead and keep going, or if Barry's going to be speaking at this time. I'm not sure which one is taking over now.
I think it's my turn, so I'll go ahead and talk about a couple more issues, and we'll still have time at the end for you to ask questions, not only about the things that I'm going to cover now, but also all the things that we've talked about during this session. So as we talked about before, the next thing we're going to be discussing is direct threat and reasonable accommodation. And as you remember, we talked about in the R-Line case, they said before you can make a decision that somebody is a direct threat, employers, you need to evaluate whether there are any reasonable accommodations that you can put in place that would lessen the possible threat to a level where it's not a significant risk of substantial harm. And while there are cases out there that talk about reasonable accommodation typically being the employee's responsibility, I think direct threat raises sort of a different kind of context for employers. And there have been cases that say by not exploring reasonable accommodations, employer, you have not fulfilled your ADA responsibility. So this kind of turns the reasonable accommodation obligation a little bit around from what we're used to. Typically, it's on the responsibility of the employee, but I think there's an argument that employers need to affirmatively evaluate possible reasonable accommodations before making an adverse decision based on a perceived direct threat. And as we talked about at the beginning of the hour, one of the ways to get information about direct threat is talking to the person with the disability directly. And again, in evaluating accommodations, talking to people about what they would need to lessen whatever threat might be available. And that's always a good practice to do. And I think courts would be very much more deferential to employers if they did undergo that affirmative discussion with employees and discussion with medical professionals before making an adverse decision. So something to keep in mind that's a little bit different than maybe some of the reasonable accommodation information you've received in the past. So the first case we're going to be talking about is a recent case from the Eighth Circuit, EEOC versus Walmart. And this is a gentleman who applied for a job. He had cerebral palsy, and he used crutches sometimes, and he also used a wheelchair sometimes. And it sort of depended on what he was doing and how he was feeling that day, that sort of thing. And he applied to be a greeter and a cashier, and he wasn't hired. And so he filed suit claiming he wasn't hired because of his disability. And in responding to that complaint, Walmart said that they perceived him to be, for a lot of other reasons, they said they gave other reasons why they didn't hire him, but one of the things they said was they perceived him to be a safety risk, or in other words, a direct threat under the ADA. And what they did was they showed that a doctor had reviewed his application after he'd come in for an interview and found a variety of risks that would happen. And you'll see those risks are listed there on the slide here, that his legs weren't capable of holding him without arm support, and that people who have those kinds of impediments would fall, that he is takes up a lot of room. He's very wide, as they say, when he used his crutches, and also that it would place him, Mr. Bradley, who was the plaintiff in, or the charging party in this case, would place him at risk. So this is not only talking about risk to other people, but risk to himself, which, as we learned earlier in the hour, is how the direct threat analysis has to go. You look at threat to self as well as threat to others. Moving on to the next slide, when the case went further, the doctor admitted that all of his opinion about Mr. Bradley was with him using his crutches and not a wheelchair. And there's some dispute on this, but one of the things that Mr. Bradley said was that they didn't want somebody who's a greeter or a cashier to be in a wheelchair in a seated position because they didn't allow other greeters and cashiers to sit down. And so that's why they were evaluating him on his crutches, but he was saying that's, you know, that's a perception thing that shouldn't be a basis for not having somebody in a wheelchair in these two positions. And the doctor also admitted that when he was in his wheelchair, he was stable, and those threats that had been identified before really wouldn't make as much sense as when he was on his crutches. And But essentially what Walmart ended up saying was they failed to prove that if you had provided reasonable accommodations to him, like letting him do his job in a wheelchair, that he would be a direct threat. And the EEOC hired an expert, which I think if you're a plaintiff's lawyer in these kinds of cases, or you're an individual with a disability bring these cases, if it's at all possible, if you have the resources, it's really important to have your own expert, because they not only looked at Walmart's expert, the doctor, but they also looked at who the EEOC's expert was. And the EEOC's expert identified a number of accommodations that would have addressed all the concerns Walmart had, different types of assistive technology, a wheelchair that would move from a sitting to a standing position, maybe a scooter stool, a lighter weight wheelchair, one that wasn't as big that took as much room. So there were a lot of things that the other side came up with that really made it difficult for Walmart to continue its position that Mr. Bradley was a direct threat. Moving to the next case is Taylor versus Rice, and this was a case that was brought on behalf of an individual who wanted to be a foreign service worker. And he had HIV. Interestingly, he had had HIV since 1985, and this case, as you see, is a 2006 case. So he'd been HIV positive for 20 years, and he had a lot of evidence that while he had HIV throughout that period, it was really for him a chronic manageable condition based on the medications that he had available. And so this was not somebody who was having extreme responses to his HIV. This was somebody who had his HIV in relatively well controlled. But he was rejected when he applied to be a foreign service officer. And the reason he was rejected was not anything specific about him or about his HIV. It was the fact that the State Department had a policy that had a complete blanket policy prohibiting hiring anybody with HIV for these positions. And this was a policy that was put in place very early when HIV first came around. And as I talked about at the beginning of the session, there was a lot of fear, and certainly still some exists, but a lot of fear in the 80s and even in the 90s about HIV. And so you see a lot of policies like this, or you did. A lot of them are being removed, but a lot of policies that had these kind of bars based on HIV, and because of I think some of the fear and ignorance about transmission of HIV and about how HIV affects different people. But basically the State Department position was that since Foreign Service means that you are frequently going to be put into places that don't have strong medical care, it would be a threat to Mr. Taylor for him to be placed out there, and that they needed to be able to deploy him worldwide, and that because of a lot of places he could potentially be deployed would not have the medical care he would need, it was a threat to his own safety. And there was a lot of disputes between the parties as far as really what was where the care was or where there wasn't. The State Department said that I think 65% of their placements were what they considered hardship locations, meaning there was a low quality of health care. And oftentimes junior people were put in these hardship positions because they didn't have much seniority. And so it was likely that he would be put in this kind of place. There was other evidence put on by the plaintiff that said, you know, about 82% of the places he could have been put had sufficient medical care to handle HIV. And so that was a factual dispute, but was part of the arguments that people were making back and forth. Moving to the next slide, the court looked at Chazabal, which we talked about before, the Chevron case, which did make clear that threat to self is something you can raise under the ADA. And the trial court said that, yes, he would be a threat to himself if he was hired and deployed to a place that did not have adequate medical care. Mr. Taylor then appealed it up to the D.C. Circuit Court, and they reversed and found in his favor, saying that there may be reasonable accommodations that could reduce any direct threat that he was having. And this goes to what I was saying before, that employers, including the State Department, need to affirmatively look at their current policies and practices, and before making a direct threat determination, decide whether there are possible accommodations that could reduce that potential direct threat. And on the next slide, you'll see Mr. Taylor had actually come up with a couple of potential reasonable accommodations. The first one that he had come up with was that that they could place him overseas in places that did not have the inadequate medical care. And again, he said 82% of the places had adequate medical care, so it wouldn't be that many places, but they could do that. And the other side, the State Department, said, well, you know, you're basically asking us to waive an essential job function. Mr. Taylor's response to that was, well, wait a second, look, there are 12 other people that you have placed as employees who had asthma, and you placed them in specific places that had medical care for asthma, and the fact that you accommodated other people and are not willing to accommodate me and having this blanket exclusion for HIV really undercuts your claim that it's an essential function, and that if you're not making worldwide deployment a requirement for other people, you shouldn't require it for people with HIV. So that really, I think, undercut the State Department's argument in that situation. The other thing that he suggested is that you can send him to any overseas post, but just allow him time to seek the medical care he needs. And the State Department said, well, that would be an undue hardship. It would take you weeks to go back and forth to get the medical care you would need. And he had his doctor say, you know, he only needs a checkup maybe twice a year, and he had evidence that showed that he could get back and forth to get the medical care he needed within just a couple of days. And so the undue hardship argument was undercut there as well. Okay. And one thing I just wanted to mention on the Taylor case is that after this case was decided in 2006, the State Department did lift their ban on hiring people with HIV. And so the ban that we talked about before, the blanket exclusion, no longer exists. So if somebody with HIV applies to be a Foreign Service officer, they can still have their own specific disability reviewed and determined whether or not they would be a direct threat, but there's no longer an inherent ban on people with HIV from being in the Foreign Service. And I think this litigation certainly went a long way to resulting in that lifting of the blanket exclusion. So we'll move on to the next case. Dart versus Curry, and this was involved a gentleman who had epilepsy, and he had had epilepsy since he was 16 years old, and he generally was able to control his epilepsy through medication. He would occasionally get what he calls auras, which are feelings that are coming that would indicate that he might have a seizure. And typically about half the time he got an aura, he would have a seizure. And sometimes he wouldn't have a seizure, but it was very rare he would have a seizure without an aura. So the aura was really a good indication that he might have a seizure. And he happened to be a construction worker. He worked with heavy equipment and driving trucks and that sort of thing. And before he went to work one day, he had an aura. But he went to work anyway, and he didn't tell anybody in the workplace that he had had this aura and that he might potentially have a seizure, which was something that was, I think, a problem for him and a problem for his employer. He ended up having a seizure while he was driving. He blacked out. He was going at a slow rate, and so another employee was able to jump on the truck and bring it to a stop. But as you can imagine, it raised quite a concern by the employer, the fact that he had had this, and if he had been going faster, somebody could have been hurt. And also, the employer was very concerned that he had had an indication he was going to have a seizure and did not tell anybody and just continued to work. And so there was that concern as well. The employer had a neurologist evaluate the employee, and the neurologist actually made some recommendations about some alternatives, said, well, maybe he shouldn't be in a position where he's driving, and he could do this job that even if he had a seizure would not be a problem. The employer reviewed that, but ultimately decided that the employee was not qualified, opposed a direct threat, and terminated him. And so moving to the next slide, you'll see that that the court ultimately found that there was a material issue of fact as to whether or not he was a direct threat. And what they were basing it on was the fact that the employer really didn't explore whether reasonable accommodation could have changed things for him. So one of the things that the court said is, you know, you've got your own doctor who said this guy could do other jobs. And so the reasonable accommodation of job reassignment is something that had been identified by the employer's own doctor, and the employer had chosen to disregard. And I think even though what happened was very serious and certainly raised a lot of concerns about this particular person's ability to do that job, the fact that the employer did not explore reasonable accommodation when he had information about possible accommodations, I think really hurt him. The other thing that happened in this case that I think is very important for employers to think about is that we had a situation of misconduct here, at least arguable misconduct, in that the person had knowledge of a problem and didn't report it to anybody. And really the employer argued that the reason they fired him was not because of his disability, but because of this misconduct. But the problem with the employer's argument was that they didn't fire him right after the misconduct, the failure to report that he was going to have that he might have a seizure. And so it really undercut the employer's argument that it was based on the misconduct and not based on the seizure. And I think, you know, if you're really going to rely upon misconduct as a basis for terminating somebody, you need to be very consistent in that and be very, you know, clear that's the reason you're doing it. Because under the ADA, an employee doesn't have to show that the only reason that they had an adverse action against them was because of disability. They just have to show that that was one of the reasons. So if the employee could show, well, maybe it was misconduct, but maybe it was also, in addition, related to my disability, that's typically going to be enough to move forward with the case. So I just think if employers really believe that misconduct is involved, they need to be consistent and act accordingly with the policies and do whatever is necessary to make that determination. And by getting that evaluation and getting that information about possible reassignment and then not acting on it really undercut the employer's argument. Okay, let's move on to the next case. And this is Jarvis versus Potter. And Mr. Jarvis was a gentleman who was actually a Vietnam veteran. And I think in the 70s or maybe the 80s, he learned that he had post-traumatic stress disorder. And the way his post-traumatic stress disorder materialized for him was that when he was startled, he would perceive it as somebody attacking him and would take him back to the war, and he would lose all sort of reality and perception, and he would just react, often physically, to any startling noise, thinking that somebody was attacking him, and it would really transfer him back to, I guess, the war, and would result in some actual violent actions that were happening. And this happened numerous times in the workplace where something would startle him, whether somebody would just walk up from behind him and touch him on the shoulder, or there'd be a loud noise or whatever. And when he would turn around and he would literally punch or kick or do sort of like a karate move against the person who had startled him. And he did it several times, and these were with coworkers who understood his disability and were sympathetic to it, and so they did not report it. But then he did it one time to somebody who was less sympathetic, and it was reported to the supervisor, and so there were real concerns about that. When this was brought to his attention, he did make an accommodation request. And his accommodation request, as you'll see on this slide, is that he requested that all of his coworkers be instructed not to startle him or approach him from behind. And he said, you know, if nobody startles me or approaches me from behind, I'm not going to have these reactions, and I'll be fine in the workplace. The other thing that happened, though, before they made a decision on this, is that when he was interviewed by his employer, he was very disclosive about his disability and gave him a lot of information. And he said, you know, he thought that his post-traumatic stress disorder was getting worse, that he, you know, really couldn't control himself when somebody approached him, and that he thought that if he hit somebody in the right place, he could actually kill them. And that he was concerned about him being safe in the workplace. Hearing that information and having the other information about the actual violence that he had done in the workplace, the employer, being the post office, placed him on leave and ultimately terminated him. So he ended up filing suit under the ADA, and as you can imagine, the post office said, he probably filed suit under Section 504 because it's a federal entity, but again, the same definition of disability. He filed under the Rehab Act, and these raised that he was a direct threat. Now, what came up in this issue, in this case, is an issue that I'll talk about in more detail in a few minutes, but it raised the issue of whose burden is it to prove direct threat. And Alan alluded to this before, and this is a tricky issue. The general rule is that it is the employer, because this is a defense that the employer raises, it's the employer's responsibility to put on enough evidence to prove direct threat. So generally, all the courts would say that. The main exception to that issue is when the essential functions of the job implicate safety issues. And if you're involved in a job that has safety issues, so maybe you're a firefighter or a paramedic or something like that, if the direct threat arises in those contexts because what you're doing really involves safety issues, it's more likely that you as the employee are going to have to prove that you're not a direct threat. But if it's not a workplace job that involves safety issues, for the most part, courts are saying it's the employer's responsibility to prove that. And so here, even though there were violence and safety issues involved, the inherent job itself, working in the mail at the post office, is not a job where you would typically think of involving safety issues. So the court said here, the exception to the general rule would not apply, and therefore it is the employer's responsibility to prove that Mr. Jarvis was a direct threat. So moving on to the next slide, the court went on to talk more about what kind of modifications or accommodations can be made in the workplace, and how a court is going to review those issues. And they said, generally, the court is not going to take the role of independently assessing whether the employee posed a direct threat. They're not going to get involved in that level of detail. But at the same time, they're not going to just say, as long as the employer acted in good faith, that's enough. Really, what you're going to do is look at some of the issues that we've talked about already. Did the employer look at the specific behavior that was involved? Did the employer look at available medical evidence about that particular disability, or talk to a doctor who had examined that particular person or knew about that person's disability? And then, is it objectively reasonable? And if it's objectively reasonable, typically the employer is going to get the benefit of the doubt, even if the employer ultimately was wrong and it's proven that maybe that all those assessments turned out not to be wrong. As long as the employer did what they needed to do and the conclusion they got to was a reasonable conclusion, courts are generally going to be deferential to employers in that situation. And in this case, moving to the next slide, the court found that the employer did meet the standard, that they did do what was necessary. They talked to the person with a disability about what was going on with his PTSD, and interviewed people that he had interacted with, and they found that they had made a decision that he did pose a direct threat, and they found that the employer had reviewed accommodations, actually talked to the person about what the accommodation would be necessary, but the employer ultimately decided, instructing other employees not to approach somebody from behind and not to startle somebody, that's really not a reasonable accommodation. That's not something we can think would really work, because in the post office area, you're moving around quite a bit. There are a lot of employees going back and forth, and it's just people are going to approach other people from behind. They're just walking from behind them, and that accommodation request really they didn't think would significantly reduce the level of threat. And I think the other thing is that there's a lot of evidence against Mr. Jarvis here. He had the prior incidences of violence, and he had his own statements that he had made that, if he hit somebody in the right place, he'd kill them. And so the employer was on notice that this is a person who was having a difficult time and was really a threat in the workplace. And the substantial harm here was great in that the employee himself said that it might result in somebody's death. The other thing that Mr. Jarvis had said was that he thought that his symptoms would last indefinitely, so this was not a situation where they could say, why don't you take a couple weeks of medical leave, and see how you feel and come back. he was saying, you know, this is something that I think is going to stay with me. It's getting worse. I don't think there's anything you can do other than tell people not to startle me. And that just wasn't enough. You know, I think this case would have been very different if the employer just knew the person had a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder and then made an adverse decision based on that diagnosis alone. But that's not what happened here. They had a lot of objective evidence, things that had happened in the workplace, and the employee's own statements that I think ultimately ended up them reaching this decision. And so you'll see on the next slide a couple of things the court said, and one was that the law doesn't require the Post Service to wait for a serious injury before eliminating the threat. They had enough information to make it. You don't have to wait for something more serious to happen to make an adverse decision. And I think that's really helpful for employers to know that, that if they've got enough, they don't have to wait for the ultimate act to happen if they have a significant risk that the substantial harm will happen. They found that this request was not a reasonable accommodation request that the employer had to accommodate. I wanted to move to two final issues, and then we'll open it up one last time for any questions. One is one that we've already talked about, and that is the issue of burden of proof. And I've sort of said some of this already, but most courts are going to require the employer to prove that the person is a direct threat, that they are a significant risk of substantial harm. And the exception, again, is if you're involved in a situation of a case that a job that has an essential function involving safety. But most courts are going to go in favor of the employer having to prove this. And for those of you who aren't lawyers, one of the things you might be asking is, well, why does it really matter who has the burden of proof? Well, it really does matter, because if you have the burden of proof, it's harder for you to prevail because you're the one who has to put on all the evidence. And so it's much easier to sort of win a case if the other side has the burden. So that's why if you can have the burden on the other side, that's a better option case. And then the other thing I alluded to, what's important to talk about, and that is that blanket exclusions of particular disabilities from different jobs, almost universally courts have found this to be a disfavored thing. And while employers have won, you know, overwhelmingly in the courts in ADA cases, where they have consistently lost cases is when they have these types of blanket exclusions or policies that are very rigid, that don't take into account individualized situations of the person. They're making a decision, like when we talked about the Taylor versus Rice case, automatic excluding all people with HIV from a particular job. That was a blanket exclusion, and the court found that that was an unreasonable policy to have. We've actually seen most of these cases involving people with diabetes, and oftentimes they're people who have jobs that involve driving. And again, while there may be a basis, and Alan talked about one of these cases where somebody who has is insulin-dependent diabetes has been found not to be qualified in a particular job involving driving, to have a blanket exclusion that nobody who is insulin-dependent driving can work a particular job is going to run afoul often of the ADA. So I think if you're an employer and you're listening, you should look and see if you have these kinds of policies. And if you have these blanket policies, I think you should really consider whether or not they need to be modified and build in the individualized assessment or have some sort of really strong evidence as to why somebody should automatically be banned because they have a particular disability or diagnosis. I'm not sure what that would be, but if you really believe strongly in that, you need to have some sort of objective medical evidence to support that. But I think the safer way to go, the better practice to go, is to really make clear what your essential functions are and then really work on identifying why a particular person with a particular disability wouldn't be able to meet those essential functions. The only exception to the rule, I would say, in the courts, I've said most courts have been very clear that if you have a blanket exclusion that you do not that you're not going to usually win these cases, is cases involving people with a history of substance abuse. And a lot of cases that have come in that kind of thing where they have a blanket exclusion saying if you have a history of substance abuse, you are not qualified for the job, courts have held that up. Not all courts, but some courts have held it up as saying that it's a business necessity because of safety issues that are involved and the history that somebody has, substance abuse, and that if they fell off the wagon, so to speak, with their substance abuse, that could hurt people, that it is reasonable for an employer to have that type of blanket exclusion. Not all courts have said that, but the only cases I've seen where employers have been successful in maintaining a blanket exclusion has been when they have one involving substance abuse. So that's just additional information that you might have in evaluating your own policies. So that gets to the end of the substantive presentation. We've got some resources listed here. Of course, you can always call your DIBTAC, including the Great Lakes ADA Center, which is taking the lead here today, as well as we at Equip for Quality of Protection Advocacy could be a resource. The Illinois ADA Project, which is funded by the Great Lakes ADA Center, is also a resource, particularly for people in Illinois. And then, of course, the Job Accommodation Network provides a lot of information through their website about accommodations that could be provided for particular disabilities. EEOC obviously has a lot of guidance and information about different topics involving employment in the ADA. And then, in addition to the Great Lakes ADA Center, there's all the other DIBTACs around the country, and there's the website link to get to your particular DIBTAC. So I think we'll just, at this point, see if there's any questions that people have. And again, if you have a question, just press your control key if you want to give it as an oral question, or you can type that in. And Matt, I see that you have a question about, is there anything in the ADA Amendments Act that will impact today's topic? You know, I don't think so when it comes to direct threat. The ADA Amendments Act really is going to the definition of disability and whether you have a disability or not, and whether or not using assistive devices or medication would affect that, or how you prove disability, whether you look at activities you do at home or activities that are central to daily lives, which was another Supreme Court case, the Williams case. But at least in my view, I don't think it's really going to impact the direct threat analysis. Alan may have a different position on that, and he can let you know. But since you brought up the ADA Amendments Act, I did want to mention, and Alan, you can go to the next slide, is that the next session that we're going to have in October 28th, we're going to actually talk about the ADA Amendments Act. It's going to be a session where we talk about a couple things. One is the EEOC's new information regarding performance and conduct issues, and Sharon Rennert from the EEOC is going to talk about that, and then we'll also talk about the ADA Amendments Act and what that means in moving forward.
I just had one point I wanted to add to Barry's. I agree that the ADA Amendments Act will not influence direct threat at all, but one thing that comes up, and I think it was in the Taylor case, is there are times when an employer perceives a person as being disabled. For example, I believe it was in the Taylor case where the employer had a statement that we think he can only work safely if in a rubber padded room with medical help right nearby. And the court took that extreme position to say, well, gee, you regard him as being disabled and working anywhere, and therefore he's regarded as being disabled. And the ADA Amendments Act makes it a little easier for employees to show that they are regarded as being disabled, because you no longer have to show that the employer perceived a substantial limitation in a major life activity, just that they perceived that you were disabled and then took an adverse employment action because of that. But other than that, I really think the Amendments Act will have no impact on the direct threat defense.
I see that it looks like we have a question regarding somebody taking a psychological profiling test. You know, I can answer that generally. I don't know exactly what the test involved. And I'm not sure if the profiling issue gets to direct threat. I guess it gets to information about possible disabilities. There is clear restrictions on employers on what they can conduct, whether they can conduct medical examinations or not. And there's a case that was brought here in Chicago that we were involved with, involving the MMPI, the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, that was given to people. And the court in that case found that the MMPI was a medical examination. It was not just a vocational test, because it would potentially be used to identify a particular disability, mental health issues. Now, that's only for the pre-employment. If after you've been deemed qualified and if they give everybody the same test, employers can do that. Even if it is a medical test, the only issue is that if they give everybody that test and then they make an adverse decision, and I mean by adverse decision, I mean withdrawing that that offer, they have to show that the reason they withdrew it was based on job-related or business necessity. So finding out that information somehow relates to the job or makes it a necessity to withdraw that job offer, and that's sometimes a difficult standard to do. But you're right that if they do have a test post-offer, they need to offer it consistently to everyone. And again, in this case for you, you were hired, so the fact that you were required to do this, and I assume it was post-offer, would likely not be an ADA violation.
And I just wanted to add, we just finished a draft of an article that touches on this issue for the ABA Journal, which talks about the personality test and looks at whether it discriminates against people with disabilities, that even beyond people with mental illness and such like that. So personally, I think these tests are problematic for a number of reasons. If an employer uses it to disqualify an applicant, I think the employer still has to meet the job-related and consistent with business necessity standard. So I just wanted to throw that in also.
Alan, it looks like there's another question for you from Peter.
I see. I'd have to double check. I think on one of them there was a regarded as issue, but I think on the other ones the court found that they had an actual disability, but I'm not 100% sure. It's interesting because you have to argue a substantial limitation in order to show you have a disability, but if your treatment regimen, for example, with Mr. Branham, his treatment regimen was helping him control his diabetes, so then is he not disabled? And in those cases, we argue that he's actually limited as well in caring for himself because of what he has to, the steps he has to take.
And, you know, that just makes me think of getting back to the previous question about whether the ADA Amendments Act is going to impact direct threat cases. I think, Robin has instructed me to repeat the question. Let me answer this question, then we can repeat the question if for future questions. But basically, a previous question was, is there anything in the ADA Amendments Act that will impact today's topic of direct threat? And I think the general answer is what we've said already, that it's not going to impact it, although it may impact regarded as. But I think getting back to what we talked about before, that so many of these direct threat cases involve people with mental illness, diabetes, epilepsy. One thing that's happened in these cases is that in addition to challenging that they have a direct threat, they've also challenged whether these people have a disability. And in a lot of these cases, those disabilities, epilepsy, mental illness, and diabetes, are people who take medication, and so a lot of these people weren't even getting past the disability stage. So I think the fact that it'll be easier for some of these people to prove they have a disability will get the case further, and then some of the direct threat analysis will proceed. But some of these cases are getting thrown out not because of direct threat, but because they couldn't prove they had a disability. Are there any final questions? I think we're at about the end of our time.
Thank you, Barry Alan, at this point, we just want to say, is there any other questions? Please make sure that you enter them either through the public chat section or you can just indicate you want to speak again, and we can take a question verbally from anyone. We're at the hour at the point, or the half hour, so want to remind people to please give us feedback on the session through the online evaluation form, and there's a link here, and it will be also sent to you following the session along with a copy of the PowerPoint presentation for you to have for future reference. I would just like to let you know that we are finalizing our schedule for the 2008-2009 webinar series. As you heard Barry and Alan allude to, our first session will be held October 28th. It will focus on performance and conduct issues, as well as an update on the Americans with Disabilities Act, Amendments Act of 2008. As you know, we're awaiting the signature of President Bush on that particular piece of legislation, which will become effective January 1, 2009. Just as an FYI, even if President Bush would decide, and we don't have any indication that he would not, But if he would veto this particular piece of legislation, there is sufficient support in both the House and the Senate to override any veto. So we're pretty assured at this point that this legislation will move forward. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission will begin its process of promulgating rules under the legislation. So join us on October 28th to learn more about the status of that piece of legislation, as well as a discussion, as I said, about performance and conduct issues. More information on the webinar series can be found at www.ada-audio.org, or if you have questions and would like to speak with someone, you can call us on our new 800 number specifically for our distance learning program, which is 877-232-1990, both voice and TTY. So thank you again for your time. Thank you, Barry. Thank you, Alan. And thank those that have joined us today. And at this time, we will sign out.